first speaker this afternoon is Jeremy Cram, grad student at the School of Forest Resources, and the title of his talk is Why Do Salmon Stray? Trade-offs Between Habitat and Homing. Jeremy?
So salmon are a critically important species to the economies, the cultures, and the ecosystems in which they occur. And one of the most defining features of salmon is the extensive migration and homing behavior that they exhibit. People have long recognized that salmon return to their natal streams from the open ocean. And more recently, a paper by Neville et al. In 2006 illustrated that they can home to within kilometers of their site of incubation. Again, in 2006, Quinn et al. Showed that salmon can indeed home to within meters of their site of incubation. So they have a strong homing fidelity to the site from which they emerged, potentially, and much stronger than just specific to the stream in which they came from. Homing behavior has evolved because it confers an evolutionary advantage to the species that utilize it. It is key in forming local adaptations, which are prevalent among specific populations of salmonids. These fish have developed different morphological characteristics or adaptations for environmental variation that may be present in their given system. It also improves the likelihood of successful reproduction because if previous cohorts successfully spawned in one area, it makes sense that future cohorts will also have success spawning in those areas. And homing behavior is not just evident in salmon. It's also exhibited by other native species in this region like mountain whitefish, large-scale suckers, and northern pike minnow, which exhibit migrations for spawning, refuge, and feeding that in many cases they seek out those same areas year after year. So if the majority of any given population homes to its natal system or even its natal area of incubation, why does some subset of the population stray? Classic examples of straying have occurred with the eruption of Mount St. Helens, where Toutle River salmon avoided the catastrophe that occurred there and subsequently recolonized that habitat when it was deemed worthy. And on a more regular basis, we have flooding in river basins all over the region, some of which are inconsequential for spawning fish, but others are catastrophic for those that did spawn pre-flood. Additionally, there are habitats that are becoming accessible now. For example, in Glacier Bay, Alaska, or in the Puget Sound at the end of the last ice age, new rivers are created as glaciers recede. Those habitats are then colonized by straying salmon. Locally in the Cedar River watershed, there was a recently constructed fish ladder over Landsberg Dam, which opened up new habitat in upstream areas there. That habitat has been colonized by strays from within the Cedar River system that are allowed to pass beyond that barrier that once existed. So the question is, are these fish straying in search of better spawning habitat? And this is the system in which we work. It's the Yakima River, highlighted here in red. It drains the eastern side of the Cascades from about Snoqualmie Pass down to its confluence with the Columbia River. Major tributaries in our study area, which again is this red section, include the Cleellum River, the lower 13 kilometers of which are accessible to migratory species, and the Tienaway River in yellow, which we survey about 35 kilometers. And indicated here are dams, these black bars. Rosa Dam is a key component of this talk, and Easton Dam is passable for these fish. The other two, Cleellum and Cachilis, are not. So the Yakima River used to support anywhere from several hundred thousand up to potentially a million salmon and steelhead on an annual basis. And As the valley became a booming agricultural area, salmon populations in this system suffered. And to combat those declines, this hatchery supplementation facility was built in 1997. To give you an idea of historic numbers, from 1940 to 1999, there were only 4 years in which spring Chinook returns exceeded 3,000 individuals. Since 2000, that's happened 8 times, so we're seeing some progress there. This is the system, the hatchery system and acclimation facilities that I'm going to talk about. Wild fish are captured at Rosa Dam. They're transported to this central hatchery in Cle Elum, where they're artificially spawned and reared for almost a year, after which juvenile Chinook are transported to one of these 3 acclimation facilities. Jack Creek is up the Tianaway, over 20 kilometers. Easton is further upstream on the Yakima, and Clark Flat, as it's known, is near Thorpe, Washington, in kind of the lower area of our study section. These fish are reared here for anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 months on average, and they're allowed to leave these areas on their own volition. The idea being that they're residing in those areas during the phase in which they imprint, so that the 2 primary goals of this supplementation effort are to increase in-stream reproduction of salmon and also to expand the spawning distribution of Chinook outside of what was currently being utilized into habitats that are considered underutilized. And why does all this matter? Hatcheries have always been controversial, and they are expensive. Washington Department of Ecology report suggested some staggering numbers of up to $500 per adult returning fish. In reality, the average number is probably much less than that. But these hatcheries, they create jobs and they do create fishing opportunity. They also, fish that are of hatchery origin pose genetic and ecological risks to native species, which are increasingly finding themselves under protection of the Endangered Species Act. And of critical importance to this supplementation type hatchery, which is different than a traditional hatchery, in which salmon would return to the hatchery itself, these fish are allowed to spawn in the river naturally with wild fish. And that is dependent on there being adequate habitat for those additional individuals to spawn. So in order to quantify habitat in this system, we conducted extensive surveys. And again, I'm mostly going to be talking about the Yakima River itself and excluding the Cle Elum and the Tianaway. So in the Yakima, we surveyed the upper 96 kilometers from Cochilas downstream to about Ellensburg. And we continuously identified habitat units. For example, this one in the aerial photo, this blue line, is a geo-referenced glide-like pool unit. As we would continuously survey this system, we would identify habitat units based on gradient, depth, and substrate, and we would collect data on a variety of habitat characteristics and also fish abundances. We were able to survey 140 kilometers of mainstem, tributary, and floodplain habitat. Mainstem and tributary habitat, and 20 kilometers of side channel habitat. This habitat component is one small part of a much broader effort to understand spring Chinook and other salmon species in the Yakima Basin. And I'm fortunate enough to have data from the Yakima Nation and NOAA Fisheries regarding the locations of reds, which are salmon nests, and carcasses is from a long-term data set. So these red dots in the lower right indicate reds where salmon spawned in 2007. Each spatially explicit point is a red in this case. We have those for carcasses as well. Each carcass can be identified as a wild or hatchery fish, male or female, And further, if it is a hatchery origin fish, they're all tagged with tags that allow us to tell which acclimation facility they were released from. So the research questions that I'm trying to examine in this talk are, how does habitat compare near each of these acclimation facilities on the Yakima River? And how does it compare at different spatial scales? Because if we're talking about straying within a system, it's relevant to talk about, are we talking about straying in the 1 kilometer scale? Are we talking about it at 10 kilometers, et cetera? And then if a fish does stray from its acclimation site, is it straying because of a better habitat, spawning habitat opportunity elsewhere? This is a busy graph, and I'm going to try and walk you through it. So we continuously surveyed habitat units from Ellensburg, which is at the left side of each of these x-axes. The x-axis is distance upstream in kilometers, going from Ellensburg to Cochilas. So along this longitudinal profile, we had originally dynamically segmented habitat units. Those units were dissolved and reformed into specified bin sizes. The bin sizes in these cases are 1 kilometer, 2 kilometer, and 4 kilometers. So instead of having a bunch of different sized habitat units, we have uniformly sized lengths of stream. And the associated characteristics within those are summarized as well. So on top is the density of reds per 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers, or 4 kilometers. And we can see a longitudinal profile of where salmon are spawning. And we can try and associate those patterns with any given habitat characteristics. In this case, I've shown percent cover of woody debris and vegetation. And then down here, a more predictable trend in stream width being wider in the downstream reaches. So with these bin data, we can use multivariate analyses. This is a principal component analysis, which essentially ranks each of these sites. And the sites here are numbered according to their kilometer distance upstream from Ellensburg. So for instance, 74 is the Easton acclimation facility occurring 74 kilometers upstream from Ellensburg. The Clark Flat facility is at 19, and the central hatchery I've illustrated on these also is at 49. And the relevance of the PCA is showing the relationship between different habitat characteristics and the sites as they appear in ordination space, and also the similarity among sites that are grouped together. So what we see emerging as the pattern driving these principal components are an upstream-downstream gradient on the x-axis here and a depth gradient on the y-axis. And the most important thing to take home is that the acclimation facilities in the central hatchery occur in very different habitat types. So then I did the same thing using 8-kilometer bins. And initially, I expected that these areas would become more similar as we zoom out, because the law of averages dictates that things might become more similar as we include more reaches. But again, we see the same pattern where Clark Flat and Easton are very different in habitat characteristics. And up here, the central hatchery occurs right on the border of 6 and 7, so I bolded those. And the next two are just different scales to illustrate that the same pattern exists. So at 250 meters, at a very fine scale, these circled sites are the 2 acclimation facilities and the central hatchery, again, showing very distinct habitat characteristics. And zooming out to 15 kilometers, we see the same pattern again. Easton occurs on the border of these two. So it's clear that habitat differences are occurring at multiple spatial scales, and how that affects homing and straying behavior in these fish is interesting. So Kiefer et al. In 2008 did a study where he monitored spring Chinook behavior in the Columbia River system, and he showed that individuals would wander up to and beyond 200 kilometers from their natal stream before homing correctly. And if that pattern is true in this system, it's reasonable to expect that these fish are encountering habitats other than the ones in which they were acclimated or were incubated. So this is a distribution of spawning with the same x-axis here, distance upstream from Ellensburg to Cochilas, and carcass density of hatchery and white and wild females. I'm using females because they are the most, their carcasses are the most likely to represent where they spawned, as opposed to males who, because of their spawning, their gender requirements, they don't necessarily guard their nest and end up depositing their carcass near where they spawn. And what we see, what we might expect, given that all of these fish are either released from the Clark Flat facility or the Easton facility, or about 20 kilometers up the Tienaway, we might expect some sort of bimodal distribution with respect to the hatchery females. But in fact, what we see is that their distribution mirrors almost exactly that of the wild fish. This is a distribution of reds looking at the same data, looking at red data rather than the carcasses, but still we're looking at the Yakima River in 2007. And these peaks outlined, circled in blue, are sites that have local maximums in spawning. So, you know, what about this site makes it special with regard to the ones around it? And so this is, again, looking at the 1 kilometer principal component analysis with sites in blue highlighted, sites that were circled in blue are now highlighted in blue. And what we see is that they occur in kind of the upstream habitats. They are they're related with a variety of different metrics in terms of their habitat characteristics. I then use the principal component scores as a predictive variable for red density. And so on the x-axis is principal component score for each site. Again, this is at the 1 kilometer scale. And on the y-axis is reds per kilometer. And again, what we see is that sites occurring towards the middle, but slightly in the positive range of the principal component axis 1, are showing the maximum spawning density that we see. An interesting direction to go with this would be to eliminate sites upstream of Easton Dam, because that seems to be a major deterrent for fish, and see if this pattern becomes a more linear relationship. And at 8 kilometers, we see the same pattern. But again, these upstream most sites don't see a lot of spawning, and they are above Easton Dam. So my conclusions are that it's obvious that habitat differences exist at multiple spatial scales near acclimation facilities. We've also seen that the distribution of hatchery and wild origin females is essentially the same. And this suggests that hatchery origin females are spawning in prime habitat, which is, it's reasonable to assume, has always been used by wild fish. However, the specific driving factors, the habitat characteristics that might lead us to restoration actions, for example, are not yet clear. And that's something that I hope to work on. And that is all.